Support for this News from Lake Wobegon podcast comes from the Sleep Number bed by Select Comfort, the bed that lets you adjust the mattress firmness to your preference, your sleep number.
Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, my hometown out there on the edge of the prairie. What a beautiful week it was. Spring comes on so slowly, comes on for weeks, edging in around us. And then suddenly, all of a sudden, it burgeons. And this last week was the week that it burgeoned. And everything happened at once. The first dandelions come in, and the poison ivy appears. And your allergies kick in, and the first mosquitoes, they all come just in one week, and the leaves fill out, the trees and the bushes all leaf out. So suddenly we have privacy again in our homes, and we're back in this little thicket, and the woods are woods with clearings, and then the woods and thickets, and it's spring, and the plows have gone through the fields. The fields are all plowed, and they're waiting for the manure, and they're waiting to be planted. And this feeling of uplift, even in the big city among you people. You grow up in South Minneapolis. It was your grandfather who came in off the farm, your great-grandfather, and yet still at this time of year, you just feel this oomph start to take a hold of you. It's your genetics. You're descended from farmers, and this is the beginning of the growing season. It wasn't because they could sit outdoors at the cafe that they got excited in May. It was because it was the start of the growing season. This was make or break time for them, and if you had a good wet winter, and if you had some good heat in July, good hot July, and then you had a good crop, and you didn't have any terrible drought, you didn't have a hailstorm, and you got a good crop, and you got a good price, then that meant that you could stay in Minnesota for one more year, and you wouldn't be forced to leave and to go out to California, as people would do who had no other choice. They would have to go out to California, and they would have to look for jobs in the movie business, and they would have to lose all sense of reality, which you do when you have no fall or winter. You live in a make-believe world, and you become a movie star, and of course you earn vast amounts of money, but you become fodder for tabloids and gossip columnists, and life is unreal for you. We avoided that. We were able to stay in Minnesota, though I understand the appeal of going to California. I go out there often, and I love to go out there, because when you go, you have this sense that nobody here knows what a failure you are. Nobody here saw you play softball when you were a kid. Nobody here knows he's the kid who went to the prom and he wore the stocking cap. And he was the only boy who went all by himself. He's the one who stood up in front of the Women's Alliance when he was supposed to recite, "O Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack. The prize we sought is won." And he couldn't remember a line. They don't know that about you in Los Angeles. You got a clean slate when you go out there, if you know what I mean. But I go back to Lake Wobegon, and there are all sorts of people look at me, and they're thinking, they're remembering. Back when I was 16, and I got the trophy at the District 16 speech tournament in oral interpretation for doing "O Captain, My Captain," and they invited me to come recite it at the Women's Alliance at their tea, and I went, and they gave me such a fulsome introduction, don't you know, about how I was bound to win the state tournament, such a big introduction that I stood up there after a big round of applause, and the captain wasn't there. The captain wouldn't come out on deck, and there was just this agonized silence, sort of like right now, just sort of an agonized silence of anticipation, and then nothing happening, and I'm left in horror and humiliation, and this lasts you for the rest of your life. You never get over it, unless you go to California. And then you are over it. I was the only boy anybody could remember who went to the prom without a date. I wore a black tuxedo, and I wore a stocking cap. just to show I was an individualist, you know. People edged away from me. They didn't want to look at me or be any part of whatever I was part of. I was the only boy without a date. I knew that girls would turn me down, so I saved them the trouble. I did it myself. I just didn't ask them. And I went, and there was the grand march. It was in the high school, the grand staircase, and they came down, one couple after another. This was a big defining moment in their lives. They came down, and the flash cameras flashed, each couple as they came down, smiling, holding each other by the elbow. And then some girls came who didn't have dates, but they were cool. They looked kind of seductive. They kind of slinked down the stairs as if there was nobody in this town who really measured up to their standards. They came down the stairs, and then I came down the stairs, ga-doink, 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 with my stocking cap on my head to show that I was some sort of an original thinker. And I went off to the gym, and the theme was Evening in Paris, and there was the Eiffel Tower painted up on one wall and little tables with candles and lilacs and little vases on them, and the buffet on one side, and the band, a saxophone band in white tuxes playing, and the chaperones moving through the dance floor with flashlights so that they could see that there was enough space in between the couples as they danced. And I just stood off to the side, and nobody asked me to dance, and I didn't ask anybody. And about 9:30, I just left and went home, and nobody seemed to miss me that much. And the worst part of it was that my parents were sanctified brethren, and so they were death on dancing. You were not supposed to dance, lest it arouse carnal impulses. Well, ha, ha, ha. So I had done something that I was forbidden to do, and there was no pleasure in it. I had sinned, and I got nothing out of it. And I was not able to tell anybody, so I had to take off my tux in the car and fold it up and put it into the shopping bag and hide it under the lilac bushes in the backyard. And a porcupine came in the night, and he chewed that to shreds, probably because he could taste all of the salt in my perspiration that was in that tuxedo. He just ate it to shreds. I take it back to the rental place in St. Cloud. Buck's rent a tux. I took it back to Buck. And Buck gave me this long song and dance about how this was the very best tuxedo in his entire shop. This was a French-made, hand-sewn tuxedo. And I owed him $225. Oh, it was a lie. I knew it was a lie. But because I couldn't go ask my dad to come stand up for me because I wasn't supposed to have had a tux and gone to the dance, I had to pay $225 to this crook. And that was the money I was planning to use to get on the bus and go to California. You see? It's a story of humiliation and of defeat. And of shame. Not that all of my life in Lake Wobegon was. Of course it was not. You walk around town on a spring day, and I walk through the town in the dark so that nobody will recognize me and remember things that they associate with me. And I walk, and here's a grassy place, and I realize that I'm in left field, and right up ahead is third base, which was the greatest triumph of my life. Back when I was 16, as a matter of fact, that summer, when I was playing third base in the father-son softball game, and my Uncle Don was at bat, and he hit this stinging liner. Well, actually, one bounce. It came one bounce, and it kicked up some chalk right on the baseline. And I just backhanded, I just stabbed my left hand over and caught it, backhanded it right there, low, like right there, in 1 second, like one rhinoceros. And I did the little hop and the step, and bango, I threw it to first, and he was out by a stride. He was in his mid-40s, but he had a lot of hustle, my Uncle Don. He was moving fast down the line. It was just the most amazing moment of my entire life, because there was a girl who was there just 15 feet away, and she was reading a book because she didn't care for softball. Louise St. Louis was there. She was somebody's cousin. She was beautiful. Young woman, she was 15 feet off the foul line, and she was reading a book, but I knew that she was watching me. When he hit that one bouncer, left hand over, hop, step, throat to first got him by a step, and I could hear her clapping for me. Her beautiful little hands were clapping for me. That was the high point of my life. I've done a lot of things since. I've written books, and I've done this show for a lot longer than you thought I would, and I have had others. I've had a number of successful marriages, but that was the one, because you see, that was the only really terrific play that I had as a softball player. You see, it's worth more. Rarity is what makes it so big and so beautiful. A man who's been shooting all day and finally hits the broadside of the barn, you see, that's a bigger success for him than somebody who has shot the cigarette out of the woman's mouth 2,675 times and then misses that one time. See, you get the drift there. I mean, it wasn't the only great play that I had. I had another great play. On that same field, 20 years later, I was 36, and I had slowed down quite a bit. And so they put me out in right field, where I could do less harm. And I played way back. I played way back, because I wasn't that good going back for a long fly. I wasn't that good coming in either, but I was especially not that good backpedaling. And so I played way back. And it was in the ninth inning. And I think we were up by a run, two runs. And they had two guys on base, and Casey came up to bat. And I was in my crouch out there, you know, trying to look good, you know, picking up little pieces of grass and toss them up in the air to see which way the wind blew them, as if I made any difference. And he hit this enormous, towering fly out towards me, and it was drifting foul, and I went with it. There was no fence over here to my left, so I kept drifting over the foul line and way over and into the parking lot. Actually, there was a pickup truck parked over there, and I drifted over behind it. I was keeping my eye on the ball, but at the same time, I could see this young woman who was lying reading a book. She was a young woman in a bikini, and she was lying on her stomach, and her bare back was there. She had taken the top off, and she was lying on her stomach, and she was reading a book. And I drifted over, and I was right beside her, and the ball was going to come right down over there. She said, "Do you want me to move?" I said, "Well, actually, I did want to move, but I didn't want to say so." And I said, no, you're fine." I said, "I'm just." She said, "Is the game over yet?" And I said, "No, it's not yet. Almost, it's almost over." She said, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm the right fielder." She said, "Oh," she said, "I'm Casey's girlfriend, Carla." I said, "Okay, all right, his girlfriend." And I was watching the ball, and I looked down, and she was reading a book of mine. Actually, she was reading one of my books, and I said, "How's that book?" I said, "I've heard good things about it." She said, "Well, it's not bad. You have to skip some, but it's okay." And then there was the ball right in my glove. Right in my glove. It would have hit her. It would have broken her back. But I caught it right there. She said, "Is the game over?" I said, "Yes, now it is." And I ran back to the field, and my teammates gathered around me, and they all slapped me on the back. But they were all men. It wasn't that big a thrill, you know? Women, we do it for women. Everything we do that's notable or interesting or distinguished or noble, it's for you. It's always been for you. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the children are above average.